Hello, hello, and welcome back to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Sweatman, and today I'm bringing you not one but two reviews of recent movies. It's Wes Anderson's The French Dispatch and Edgar Wright's Last Night in Soho. After that, we are starting a brand new series that I'm very excited about and something that's very personal to me. I'm calling it The Art of Deconstruction: Faith, Doubt, and Film. I'll be looking at a series of films with a variety of guests, talking about the religious themes in those movies and sharing personal stories of evolving faith. Stay tuned for that, don't go anywhere, and enjoy the show.
It began as a holiday. Eager to escape a bright future on the Great Plains, Arthur Howitzer Jr. transformed the series of travelogue columns into the French Dispatch, a factual weekly report on the subjects of world politics, the arts, high and low, and diverse stories of human interest.
You don't think it's almost too seedy this time?
No, I don't.
For decent people.
It's supposed to be charming.
He assembled a team of the best expatriate journalists of his time. Berenson, Sazerac, Kremenz, Roebuck, Wright. These were his people.
Just try to make it sound like you wrote it that way on purpose.
We take as the subject of tonight's lecture Mr. Moses Rosenthaler. Certainly the loudest artistic voice of his rowdy generation.
Simone Naked Cell Block J Hobby Room. I want to buy it.
It's not for sale.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
Yes.
In short, the picture was a sensation.
That was the trailer for the latest from director Wes Anderson, The French Dispatch. The film has an enormous cast, including Benicio del Toro, Adrian Brody, Tilda Swinton, Lea Seydoux, Frances McDormand, Timothy Chalamet, Jeffrey Wright, Bill Murray, Owen Wilson, and even more than that. Once upon a time, Wes Anderson was an up-and-comer, making waves with his unique visual flair and droll sense of humor. But now he's pretty firmly established as one of the most prominent working American directors. It doesn't feel quite right to consider him an indie darling anymore, especially considering how star-studded his films have become, and none more so than this one, The French Dispatch. Wes Anderson's style has become incredibly distinct. If you've seen even just one or two of his films, you can recognize a Wes Anderson movie from a mile away. When a director's work is particularly recognizable like that, it's fascinating when they make a new film to see to what degree they remain faithful to that style or how much they choose to change it up. In the case of The French Dispatch, it feels like a Wes Anderson film through and through, but it also doesn't feel like he's simply giving us more of the same. Starting with the Grand Budapest Hotel, it seems that Anderson has entered a new phase of his career. The visual flair is still there, but it feels less showy. The symmetry, the close-ups, the intricate production design, these things are not toned down at all in the Grand Budapest Hotel, but they are more tightly integrated into the film in such a way that they feel more natural, more part of the background. The showmanship is taking a backseat to the story, and everything feels a bit more organic. That trend continues here in The French Dispatch, with Anderson giving us a series of vignettes that are densely plotted and quickly paced, though the pace does slow down very intentionally at times to allow moments to land. And it's incredibly effective. When compared with The Grand Budapest Hotel, the tone and the pace of this film are very similar, but what's different are those emotional beats. They're much more compelling and memorable here. Since the beginning of his career, the extravagant visual touches and deadpan performances Anderson brings could sometimes have the effect of keeping the viewer at arm's length as a passive observer. But the experience of watching The French Dispatch feels more immersive and more personal than anything he's made before. This film follows the titular French Dispatch, which is a journalistic publication in the tradition of The New Yorker, but transplanted to the fictional city of Ennui, France. At the film's outset, the Dispatch's founder and editor, Mr. Arthur Howitzer Jr., played by Bill Murray, dies, and we learn that the publication is set to fold along with him. We then dive into three articles that will be published in the final edition of the Dispatch, each written by a different character in the film, and featuring a diverse ensemble and a peculiar story. and what wonderful stories they are. Anderson based some of the characters and accounts on real people and events, but if you go into the film not knowing any of that, like I did, you'll be just fine. The first vignette, called The Concrete Masterpiece, features Benicio del Toro as a painter who becomes famous despite being incarcerated in Anhui's prison, and the way the story unfolds sets the stage for the film's unusual narrative structure. Not only is the film essentially an anthology, divided into discrete chapters, but each section is told from a variety of vantage points. Ultimately, a dispatch writer is narrating each story, but in the case of The Concrete Masterpiece, the story jumps around in time, with even the narration itself coming from different points in the story's timeline. Tilda Swinton plays J.K.L. Berenson, the writer of this piece, and some of the narration seems to be happening in the present, but we also jump forward in time to see an older Tilda Swinton giving a lecture on the history of this artist's life and most prominent work to fill in some of the details. It's a very creative way for the plot to unfold. The main thematic thrust of this section deals with the sticky relationship between art and commerce, commenting on how we consume art, how artists get discovered, and the mysterious nature of inspiration. Del Toro is delightfully scuzzy as the artist Moses Rosenthaler, and Lea Seydoux gives one of the standout performances of the film as his muse. Adrian Brody plays Julian Cadazio, a somewhat skeevy art dealer who champions Rosenthaler's work, which would otherwise have faded into obscurity. Next up is Revisions to a Manifesto by Lucinda Crimmins, played by Frances McDormand in the film. This story follows Zeffirelli, played by Timothy Chalamet, his group of student revolutionaries, and his unexpected romantic entanglements. Most notable in this section is the theme of journalistic integrity and whether such a thing even exists. Notably, all of the writers in this film become part of the story that they're writing. Zeffirelli and his fellow rebels are sometimes unclear on what exactly they're rebelling against, and he sets out to write a manifesto to set the record straight. This story also deals with the nature of revolution and features a hilariously frumpy Christoph Waltz. Finally, a writer named Roebuck Wright recounts his story called The Private Dining Room of the Police Commissioner. It's a caper involving a chef, a kidnapped child, and Roebuck Wright himself, played by Jeffrey Wright, and it's got to be one of his very best performances. Wright recounts the time he was invited to dinner by a senior police officer on the same night that that officer's son was kidnapped and held for ransom. The ensuing rescue operation is downright zany, unfolding partially in a striking animated sequence before leading to one of the film's most touching moments. Roebuck Wright and the subject of his story, Chef Nescafier, played by Stephen Park, share a brief but significant conversation on the subject of living as foreigners, which serves as a lovely coda to this section and is perhaps the standout moment in the entire film. Woven in between and within each of these primary vignettes are interactions between dispatch staff members, all of whom are introduced at the beginning of the film as they review, edit, and comment upon the story at hand. This construction, along with the carefully worded and eloquent narration of the articles themselves, makes the film feel thoroughly literary. It's filled with dense and flowery writing, which is sure to reward repeat viewings. All of this is set to another wonderful score from longtime Anderson collaborator Alexandre Desplat, making this film's 103-minute runtime fly by. Returning to the question of Anderson's evolving style, one of the key elements that has changed over the years is the nature of the performances he gets from his actors. I think this started with Ralph Fiennes and his performance in The Grand Budapest Hotel. He plays Monsieur Gustave H., and he's broad and comedic, but also warm and personal, which is pretty different than a lot of the wry and deadpan performances we get in Anderson's earlier films. I think often of Bill Murray's character in Rushmore, Herman Bloom, when he says dryly, "Never in my wildest imagination did I ever dream I would have sons like these." These characters in The French Dispatch, like Gustave H. before them, are rich, human, and charming, which works to bring together all of the other filmmaking elements that make up this eclectic film. The score, the set design, the far-reaching plot, the wordy narration, something about the acting in this film makes it feel like a unified whole despite its fractured structure. The performances, along with the thematic connections that bind the vignettes together, lead to a film that feels complete in a way that's intensely satisfying to experience. The French Dispatch is a quick-witted and pleasant ode to creativity and the written word. Always charming and at times touching, the film serves as a sophisticated celebration of culture and storytelling, and it practically demands repeat viewings, not only to unearth the many delights of its dense narration, but also to re-experience the many, many wonderful performances that anchor it, keeping it just grounded enough. The film also stands as a complex meditation on the nature of art, arguing that even the least known artists should take their work seriously, and that great value lies in appreciating the furthest corners of human culture. The French Dispatch is a masterpiece, standing out as the greatest film in Wes Anderson's already remarkable body of work, and it is certainly one of the very best films of the year. The French Dispatch is now playing in theaters.
A message from the foreman. 1 hour to press.
You're fired.
Really?
Don't cry in my office.
Do you like popcorn? Silly question. You're listening to a movie podcast. Of course you like popcorn. I love popcorn, and I love trying different ways of making it. But I run into an issue. Stovetop popcorn tastes amazing, but it's a lot of work. You have to get your pot, your oil, do all the seasonings yourself. Microwave popcorn is much easier, but typically it's not nearly as good. Until now, I recently discovered a product that completely solves this problem. It's called OPopPop, and they make flavor-wrapped popcorn kernels that give you premium popcorn quick and easy from the microwave. OPopPop even comes with its own special popping bowl that ensures your kernels pop perfectly every time, and it comes in a variety of tasty flavors like vanilla cake pop, Maui heat, salted umami, and fancy butter. Don't worry, they have variety packs, so you can try them all. If you're a popcorn lover, it's perfect for you, and it also makes a great holiday gift for the movie lover in your life. I'm a big fan, I've been eating it a lot, and you can get 10% off your first order right now if you go to arthousegarage.com/popcorn, or click the link in the show notes. All right, back to the show.
Baby, you don't know what you say.
So what brings you down then?
I'm studying London College of Fashion.
Room is on the top floor.
It's perfect. I love it. If I could live any place in any time, I'd live here in London in the 60s. Something in my dreams. There was a girl.
And you are?
Sandy.
That was the trailer for Last Night in Soho, the latest from director Edgar Wright. Edgar Wright's films have always had a strong connection to music. Way back in Shaun of the Dead, we see Shaun and Ed arguing over which records to throw at the zombies that are attacking them.
Now, some of these are limited.
What was that?
I think it was Blue Monday.
That was the original pressing.
Purple Rain. Sign of the Times.
Definitely not.
The Batman soundtrack.
Throw it.
And then later, Shaun and his friends fight zombies in a hilarious dance sequence set to Queen's Don't Stop Me Now.
Why is Queen still on?
We have a situation! I know!
In Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, the film is chock full of beautifully fuzzy garage rock from all the musicians in the film, including Scott's band Sex Ba-Bomb. Baby Driver is essentially a feature-length music video with almost everything happening on screen synchronized to the music on the eclectic soundtrack. Earlier this year, Edgar Wright released a music documentary about the band Sparks called The Sparks Brothers.
Kentucky Tigers, this is only big enough for the both of us.
and now Wright has created a supernatural thriller imbued with the sights and sounds of the 1960s in Last Night in Soho.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown. When you've got worries, all the noise and the hurry seems to...
Last Night in Soho's protagonist, Ellie, played by Thomasin McKenzie, is a fashion student who is obsessed with 1960s music and culture. Ellie's vinyl collection, her clothing designs, and later her dreams are heavily inspired by that 1960s style. Ellie is also leaving her rural home for the first time and headed for London, where she's been accepted to a fashion program, and her grandmother warns her repeatedly to be careful in the dangerous city. We learn also that Ellie's mother, quote, couldn't handle London and suffered some sort of mental health episode that resulted in her death some years earlier. Ellie may also be a medium. It's hinted that she has a history of seeing people, including her late mother, that others can't. Ellie's nostalgia is strong, and when we finally become immersed in the 1960s alongside her, in the film's first extended dream sequence, the setting is beautiful and fully realized, making it feel just as vibrant and exciting for us, the audience, as it is for Ellie. She also has a mysterious connection to a woman in her dreams named Sandy, played by Anya Taylor-Joy. Sandy is a doe-eyed beauty in Ellie's nighttime alternate reality, and their strange link is incredibly compelling. In the initial dream sequence, Sandy shows up to a nightclub determined to make an impression on music producer Jack, played by Matt Smith, as she's longing to make it big as a star on the stage. The set design, the costumes, and the music in this film, especially in those 1960s sequences, are absolutely top-notch and one of its greatest strengths. Also fantastic is the camera work, as it so often is in Edgar Wright's films. Wright has always had a strong eye for visuals. He's never content to give us boring camera angles or lighting choices. When Ellie settles in for her first night in the new room she's renting to avoid her horrible college roommate, the flashing neon sign outside her window bathes the room in alternating red and blue light. This ends up being a recurring visual that represents the sort of twilight between worlds she experiences in that room. Also, in the dream sequences, there's a recurring visual motif involving reflections that helps to establish the alter ego nature of the connection between Ellie and Sandy. Their directorial decisions around these visuals are handled perfectly. Sometimes we see Sandy in Ellie's dreams, sometimes we see Ellie in her place, and sometimes we see them both with the help of a nearby mirror. In these reflections, Ellie and Sandy move in lockstep most of the time, but at certain moments this connection intentionally breaks and Ellie becomes an observer more than a participant in the dream. These are some of the best sequences of the whole film. There's a great moment at the beginning of Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, when Knives Chow sits down on a couch and hears Scott's band play for the first time. We see the band through her eyes, and as she's watching him, the camera pulls back and further back and further back, revealing that the tiny living room they're in has become impossibly long. Knives is obsessed, totally immersed in the music. She has tunnel vision. There's a parallel moment in Last Night in Soho when Ellie settles into bed for the first time in her new room, pulling the blanket over her head as the camera pulls back and back and back, revealing that she's laying in an absurdly enormous space underneath the sheets. It clues us into Ellie's reality. She's feeling free in her new independent life, and it also points to the fact that she's about to enter another world. Most of the performances in the film are also really solid. The movie asks a lot of Thomasin McKenzie, and she gives a magnificent performance as Ellie. And Anya Taylor-Joy is also pitch perfect as Sandy. She really matches the dreamy quality of the scenes she's in. Diana Rigg is also in the film. A lot of people probably recognize her as Lady Tyrell from Game of Thrones. She also gives a great performance, and sadly one of her last since she passed away last year. The film appears to be dedicated to her as well, with the words "For Diana" appearing at the end of the opening credits. Matt Smith is also in the film as the handsome music producer Jack. So much of his presence in the film relies on his physical appearance, and he certainly looks the part. One character that doesn't quite work, though, is Ellie's classmate John. The performance by Michael Ajayo isn't bad per se, but his energy doesn't really match the rest of the film in a way that really stuck out, and he also lacks the chemistry with Thomasin McKenzie that his role really requires. The first half of this film is engrossing and thrilling as we get to know Ellie and the unusual situation that she's found herself in. Around the halfway point comes an interesting development that shatters Ellie's idealistic vision of the 1960s, turning her nostalgia nightmarish. And sadly, shortly after this is the point that the quality of the film really goes downhill. The script stops feeling cohesive and fails to pay off the really good beginning of this film. Character decisions stop making sense, the plot twists and turns are not as compelling as they should be, and the exposition never feels organic. As dreams and real life begin to blur for Ellie, the story devolves into endless repetitive scenes of her running from place to place, pursued by the supernatural forces that have begun to encroach upon her waking reality. This film's heart is in the right place, though. The message about abuse of women, and especially women in the entertainment industry, comes through loud and clear and serves as a really fresh way of subverting the nostalgia baked into the film's setting. The script by Christy Wilson-Cairns is clever and draws connections to our present reality by showing that Ellie's experience in the modern world is also much more fraught with danger simply because of her gender. That message is important and timely, but unfortunately it's wrapped up in an overlong and lackluster mystery that doesn't pay off in a cohesive or satisfying way. Edgar Wright has a really impressive track record as a filmmaker, and he's responsible for some of my very favorite films. I really wanted to love this movie, and Last Night in Soho has a lot going for it. An incredible setting, it sets up a really compelling mystery, it has great performances from its leads, but unfortunately it fails to live up to the rest of Wright's filmography. The script starts strong and is full of compelling ideas, but the finale fails to execute and ultimately the film falls flat because of it. If you're a big fan of Edgar Wright, Anya Taylor-Joy, or the 1960s in general, you'll find a lot to like about Last Night in Soho, because the first half really is bursting with creativity. Just don't expect too much from the ending. Last Night in Soho is now playing in theaters.
I know what you did.
I've done a lot of things. You're gonna have to be more specific, love.
You can't save me.
And now it's time to begin our brand new series, which I'm calling The Art of Deconstruction, Faith, Doubt, and Film. If you're new to this podcast, my name is Andrew Swetman. I'm the host and creator of Arthouse Garage. I was raised Christian, and I'm still a Christian, though my faith has changed significantly over the years as I've shed many of the beliefs I was taught growing up. Through that process, I've become fascinated by hearing other people's stories of faith changes, and I thought that might be a really fruitful topic to explore through a podcast series. My guests are people like me who have experienced significant changes in their religious and spiritual lives, and we're going to talk about those changes through the lens of film. I have asked each of my guests to select a film that has been especially meaningful to them as they've gone through their religious deconstruction. Most of my guests are people like me who grew up evangelical, but no longer hold many of the beliefs central to evangelicalism. My first guest for this series is named Andrew Bocock. He is going to tell you all about himself in a moment, but Andrew is a filmmaker and a fellow ex-evangelical who I met at a virtual movie gathering that he was hosting. The film Andrew selected is Winter Light, directed by Ingmar Bergman. It came out in 1963. This is one of my very favorite Bergman films because it deals so much with faith and doubt. If you don't know much about Bergman, he's a Swedish filmmaker who directed some of the greatest films of all time, including The Seventh Seal, Wild Strawberries, Persona, Scenes from a Marriage. He's a really important person in the film world. By the way, I did an episode on The Seventh Seal, one of his other films, way back in episode 26, so look that up if you're interested. So many of Bergman's films deal with faith, some explicitly with loss of faith, so he's the perfect fit to be the first film in this series. We talk about the plot of Winter Light, but I'll go ahead and give the broad strokes here. The film is about a pastor at a small rural church named Tomas. He meets with one of his church members after the service one day, a man named Jonas, and discovers that Jonas is having an existential crisis and questioning the existence of God. He also is showing signs of suicidal ideation. Meanwhile, Pastor Tomas has an ex-lover asking him repeatedly to marry her, and he seems uncomfortable with her advances. About halfway through my conversation with Andrew, we are going to talk about a plot point that could be considered a spoiler, but we do give a warning, and there's lots of good stuff before that, so I encourage you to keep listening at this point. And as we discuss later in the episode, It's not really a spoiler movie. Even if you know the entire plot of Winter Light, the experience of watching it is so much more about the incredible dialogue, the performances, the camera and lighting choices. The craft on display is arguably much more important than the plot. But if you do want to watch Winter Light unspoiled, wait for our spoiler warning and then tune out. I'll also pause here to give a quick content warning. We do talk about suicide and suicidal ideation as it pertains to the film in this conversation. We're very respectful about those topics, and really we kind of barely mention it, but I thought it might be worth mentioning in case you're not up for that today. And with that, here is my conversation with Andrew Bocock about Winter Light.
Winter Light. Ingmar Bergman, the most celebrated and distinguished filmmaker of our time, presents his first film since winning 2 Academy Awards. Bergman reaches new heights in dramatic achievement as he explores the life of a country pastor, his relationship with his mistress, and the people around him. Starring Gunnar Bjornstrand as the pastor, struggling to find God and love in a winter world. And as his mistress who sheds all pride in a desperate effort to give her love, Ingrid Tulin. With the star of The Seventh Seal and The Virgin Spring, Max von Sydow. And Gunnell Lindblom. As a tormented fisherman and his wife, a strange couple, caught up in the compulsive fears of a world they see only as hostile.
Welcome to the show, Andrew Bocock. I'm so excited to talk to you today, and thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man. This is my bread and butter, so to speak. I haven't done a podcast in quite some time, but you know, I used to like doing these once and again. So
nice. Well, cool. I didn't know that about you, so I'll have to go search your name in the podcast app. But so we met through this film club that you're, I think, going to talk about a little bit later. That I was invited to and ended up being about faith in film. And I was so excited about that. I don't always have the time to go these days. I try to as much as I can, but I guess we kind of connected on a faith in film level. So I thought of you when I wanted to, you know, kick off this series. So I'm going to ask you about your faith in just a minute. He knows these questions are coming. But because this is the first episode of this series, I thought I'd tell my own story really briefly. And I'm sure as, you know, I do more episodes about this, more details will come up and as we talk later. But so I'm gonna keep it short. But essentially, I was raised really conservative, Southern Baptist, evangelical, preacher's kid, in fact. And it's so interesting that, like, kind of looking back, so we're going to be talking about faith changes and the kind of the way my faith has changed is looking back, I can see like there were seeds of doubt about some of my religious beliefs way back in junior high and high school. And over time I had more and more doubts about things and I just kind of did my best to ignore them and push them aside. The way I've started thinking about it is like there was like a series of dominoes that set up over time and all these doubts, you know, kind of growing and growing. And then eventually something came and kind of knocked them all over. So one domino was the idea of evangelism. Another might have been a belief in biblical inerrancy or the treatment of women and kind of gender issues or the exclusion of LGBTQ+ people. Like all these things over time, I was like, I don't know if I really agree with, you know, the things my church has taught me about this. And basically what then knocked those dominoes over where I couldn't ignore it anymore was two things. One was becoming a parent in 2015. I had my first child. And I think parenthood affects a lot of people in that way. And for me too, is because my child has a disability. And that really, I think, caused me to just look at the whole world in a different way and really kind of examine my faith and the churches I was going to and all of that. And at that point, I think I really realized there's a lot of different kinds of Christians out there besides the kind that I am, which, you know, claims to be the only true kind. And so that was a big deal for me to realize that. And then the second thing that happened was the 2016 election, which I think for a lot of people was a big inciting thing. And, you know, I was just so befuddled and dismayed to see such kind of widespread evangelical support for Donald Trump. And it kind of it served to confirm like my worst fears that so much of the evangelical world is, or the Christian leaders at least, is more concerned with like power than it is about, you know, the actual teachings of Christ and morality and ethics and all of that. So that was profoundly disillusioning. And then since then, it's just been, you know, a journey of figuring out what now, and learning that there's so many resources for people just like me, like that are, you know, ex-evangelical. And it's almost this whole subculture now. And then there's, there's so much common ground to find with other people. So that's kind of the short version of things. So that's where I'm at. So I was curious to hear about you and your religious experiences, just however much you're comfortable sharing, How they've kind of changed over time.
that's a lot, man. I'll say this out the gate. I'm not really known for brevity, but I'm going to try to hit the biggest points without dragging things out too much, but without skirting over too much either.
Yeah.
So I grew up in Northern California, a place called Fairfield, about an hour outside San Francisco. And I was very, very active in church my whole life. I grew up, again, probably similar to you, not a pastor's kid, but fundamentalist house. Mm-hmm. Very structured. My parents were from a Baptist background, but I kind of dipped my finger in a lot of different denominations, so to speak. My parents took me to during my formative years, I went to a Pentecostal church, which was interesting because my parents, they had this sort of, when you think of, if you're really in the weeds in evangelicalism, you have these sort of schisms between people who are Baptist or what have you, who are in the camp you call like cessationist, who don't believe in what they call, quote, the gifts of the Spirit, speaking in tongues, all that kind of stuff. And then there's Pentecostals. That movement started about 100 years ago with Amy Semple McPherson, and sort of this more flamboyant, more kind of dramatic kind of Christianity that's based around feeling. It's got like this new agey sort of feeling if you're kind of from the outside looking in. Very sort of spiritually paranoid too. And I think that's where my parents kind of bled into this a little bit, because even though they didn't do the speaking in tongues stuff, they thought that stuff was all weird, but when it came to like demons and all of that was I think they were sort of taken into the satanic panic stuff, you know, with a lot of the church. So I was not allowed to watch anything with ghosts or demons or like anything like that. You know, I could watch James Bond all I want. I mean, but if it had, you know, I couldn't watch Casper or like stuff like that. But still strict, can't watch R-rated movies, all that kind of stuff.
I just told some friends the other day that I was not allowed to watch Casper, and they were so shocked by that. I was like,
totally. I mean, saved at age 5, said the sinner's prayer, very, very involved in church and youth group, various kinds. I went to Baptist youth group. I went to my church's Pentecostal youth group. I became a youth leader. I became a worship leader. I got pretty deep into all that stuff. but in high school, I discovered that the arts was a huge passion for me. I got into theater. I got into acting. That was really fun stuff. And that was a bridge. I went to a charter magnet school. They had a lot of classes for film appreciation, stuff like that. So I started taking film classes. I discovered film was my thing. I really wanted to do it. But I also felt sort of this weight that I needed to be pulled into ministry. And so I had a plan. I came up with a plan. I'm going to go to Bible college, and then I'm going to kind of figure out what my whole belief system's all about, you know, because I'm still, I'm a growing Christian. I don't know everything. I want to figure out the core of my belief system, all that kind of stuff. And then once I get that stuff out of the way, I will have a solid foundation to step into the world and be like this filmmaker for God and whatever. But caveat, oh, I want to be like the cool kind of filmmaker. I don't want to be the Kendrick Brothers and all those Kirk Cameron kind of things. I was like, they got some ingredients missing there. I feel like I'm the guy to help them figure it out. So, you know, sort of the savior complex a little bit going into it. So I went to Life Pacific College in Southern California, formerly Life Bible College, now known as Life Pacific University. And so things started to shake up a little bit, a little less than a year in, well, second semester, I guess, into my Bible college experience. Because I started to really realize that a lot of my beliefs didn't really make sense upon scrutiny. Mm-hmm. You mentioned a lot of those dominoes.
Yeah.
The big one for me was the doctrine of the Trinity. Because I was there and I met somebody who was not a Trinitarian. And he couldn't tell people that because it would get him in trouble. So there was like this secret thing. So then I started to talk to people about it and they're like, oh man, that's scary stuff. Like don't touch that. You know, this was like a sacred cow.
Yeah.
But yeah, I started to analyze the Greek texts, kind of break down the original verses. I started to realize a lot of verses were inserted. A lot of verses were changed or taken out by church leaders throughout the centuries. So I was kind of like, hey, if they fucked around with this one issue, how much can I trust this book in my hand to be authoritative about any number of other issues? And so the ultimate irony for me here was I submitted a paper for a case study in a theology class based on all of this research I was doing, defending the doctrine of the Trinity. And this was for a theology professor who is very difficult to please, mind you. So I'd submitted other papers before this that I thought were pretty good previously. And I received less than stellar grades. And I mean, this was one of those harsh college experiences where I was like, oh man, I would have like totally aced this in high school. But he's like picking apart my arguments a little bit here and there. But my Trinity paper, I got an A+ on that one. And that just made me really sad because I realized that I knew how to defend this doctrine that I now knew was total bullshit.
Yeah. Wow.
Mm-hmm. So this is sort of like this rude awakening for me. And so I don't like you. I mean, I'd always struggle with some sense of doubt or what have you. But this was like my first experience of full on deconstruction mode. Mm-hmm. And it never really let up since. So if anybody out there is listening and kind of feels like they're pushed into this realm of where we are a bit, like this deconstruction, things are starting to fall apart for them. A lot of people feel like, oh, deconstruction is just a phase or whatever. Mm-hmm. But let me tell you guys, some people think it might be, but it was damn near a couple decades for me. I'm at a place now where I feel like I'm kind of past deconstruction a little bit. And I'll talk about that in a little later, but not that you ever fully get out of it, but I'm just saying, I feel like I have moved past the struggle for me, the biggest parts of the struggle. And now I'm in a different place of healing that I think I need to focus on for myself and sort of becoming just a healthier and a better person. So yeah, that kind of unraveled a lot of stuff for me. I mean, throughout all of that at Bible college, I still consider myself a Christian, believed in God, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it made me an outsider. I never really felt like I was part of the team as much after that. And so kind of one of the things I got to do during this time was I made a mockumentary with some friends, a feature length mockumentary, actually, kind of Christopher Guest style. So it's something like a Spinal Tap, but it was making fun of like a youth group worship band who thought that they were like
amazing.
Yeah, who they thought they were hot shit and they're the next big thing, but they're like trying to serve God and do all this fundamental stuff. It was really funny, actually. Like, I still look back on that movie and I cringe at some of the amateur filmmaking because I didn't quite know what I was doing at the time. But there's a lot of really funny stuff in it. And especially if you grew up in the church, a lot of it, I think, will resonate with people. Sorry, I know I'm going on a bit, but I mean, I'm trying to hit all the bullet points, man. Like, this is still my condensed version because I could talk about this for hours on end. But anyway, so when I discovered all of this stuff that, okay, ministry's not for me. Okay. Mm-hmm. Like, I may be a Christian. I'm going to figure that stuff out. But all I know is this whole ministry thing, that's out of the question now. Like, I need to embrace a craft that helps me explore what all of this is. And so I knew Biola University had a great film program, another conservative evangelical college, but they were an accredited university. And they, again, I'd heard great things about their film program. So I ended up transferring there. And if it wasn't for the fact that I had been at Bible college and took all these Bible classes, I wouldn't want to have any association with a religious institution whatsoever. But I wanted to finish in 4 years. I wanted my Bible credits to count for something. Yeah. So I was like, I'll go to Biola. I'll get, you know, move that towards getting my degree and get the best of both worlds, you know, problem solved. So when I was at Biola, that's where I encountered the spark of what I think turned me into a cinephile. So a good friend of mine, Jonathan Borello, was a fellow movie geek, and he started the college radio show / podcast, which actually he asked me to co-host with him. And on the show, we watched and reviewed obscure films. Nice. And through this process, I found some of these films that I had never heard of before in my life became some of my favorite movies. Mm-hmm. And they really pushed the expectations of what I thought was possible with this medium. And so I fell even more in love with film from a different angle. This is leading up to where we're going in this whole thing. During this process, that's when I discovered Ingmar Bergman. I first heard about him really when he died in 2007. It was around that time he was kind of in some headlines. I was like, oh, who's this guy? Oh, the guy who did Seven Seal. Okay. Yeah. I remember seeing that. That was interesting. So, I had some friends telling me that I should check out some more of his films. I saw Wild Strawberries and I thought there was something ineffably great about it. Mm-hmm. And it really cut to the core of what I love about film on so many levels. And so I ended up going to my local library and I just literally checked out every Bergman Criterion DVD I could get my hands on. I probably saw a dozen of his films in the first month or so of hearing his name.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot. The films are dense and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. And just for context, now to date, I think I counted this morning, I've seen 46 Bergman films.
Wow.
So that's more than any filmmaker by a country mile. So everybody always considers me the Bergman expert guy, whatever.
I didn't know that either. Nice. So, perfect.
Yeah. So what drew me to Bergman during this time in my life, he was the first filmmaker who I felt just a full on kindred spirit with. Mm. Like I said, I'd saw Seventh Seal before and liked it, but it was after digging in to this deep dive that I just realized that Seventh Seal, as much as I liked it, was actually to me one of his lesser films. Like, not lesser, but I would consider it maybe like middle tier for me. The Virgin Spring is what I saw that kind of just blew my mind apart the first time I saw it.
It's amazing.
And that film, actually, I would probably still consider that my favorite film of all time. His films were intimately and explicitly asking questions I was having and sifting through right then and there in my life. Mm. But he was also an incredible artist and writer. So practically every one of his films just floored me with how they were crafted. And it wasn't just His attitude as well, just, I felt very earnest to me. So it wasn't just like pure cynicism.
Right.
Mm-hmm. These are very dark and bleak films, just by the pure nature of their blunt honesty, I think. Mm-hmm. But he also knew how to weave in humor and glimmers of hope and sort of reasons to like keep living and pursuing love. So yeah, he became sort of like my artistic muse. I mean, I wanted to be a filmmaker already, but he, I think, identified what kind of feelings and thoughts I want to evoke in films that I make. Mm-hmm. So a little bit, just to kind of cap off back to my own story. After I graduated from Biola, I tried on different religious shoes or like church denominations. And I was just like, none of this really fits for me. I still don't feel welcome. I feel anywhere fully because some of my fringe beliefs or I can't fall in line with these like creeds that they have or whatever. And the insistence I had on investigating and critiquing what I found to be harmful beliefs, eventually it led me to just, it just led me out of the church. I was like, look, I don't think this is for me anymore. And the domino at this point in my life, the Trinity stuff was already, that had kind of like, I put that to bed. I was like, whatever, that's a stupid thing. I'm done with it. I know where I stand on it. I just think it's some structure that people try to grasp on to kind of box in this idea of God or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the LGBTQ thing, that was a biggie for me because I had friends who were in that, not just friends that are people that I knew, but just studying, you know, just basic human biology and other just even philosophy and ethics. It just didn't make any sense to me. The conservative evangelical ostracizing of that whole community. I mean, the whole thing was just rotten to me. But after being out for a while, I missed church, you know, I missed community. Mm-hmm. So I eventually did some Googling where I was living at the time in Glendale. And I found Central Avenue Church in Glendale. Shout out to them, my good friends over there. And frankly, I owe them a lot because not only did they welcome everybody and welcome intellectual interrogations of harmful beliefs, they encouraged it on a weekly basis. And they had a Q&A. They still do this, you know, they have a Q&A after every service. It's like whether the lead pastor Aaron speaks or whoever, they have this conversation. He gives sort of his take on an issue or a sermon, however you want to say.
Sure.
But, and then afterwards it opens up. People can give their input, ask questions, whatever. That was the first time I'd ever seen a church like that, that literally like was encouraging critique.
Yeah.
Actively. So yeah. And that community is made up mostly of ex-evangelicals. So at the time, none of us, I think, really knew that term.
Yeah.
It was really that podcast ex-evangelical that sort of catapulted that, you know, that into a community of people finding each other in the last couple of years and sort of realizing, understanding religious trauma, all that kind of stuff. So these are all like progressive Christians, or not just progressive Christians, but people who maybe even identify as atheist, but they appreciate and like the structure of the church atmosphere. So my friend, the pastor, Aaron Van Voris, he encouraged me to host this group. Because I told him about how it was a passion of mine to have discussions around film and how it spoke to me and helped me through a lot of shit in my life. And I mean, this is a passion, not just to do, but it just in every aspect, it's an obsession of mine. But I think I can actually facilitate conversations with people who feel similarly about this kind of stuff, or maybe not feel similarly, but who are curious, and then kind of like, I can invite them into my cult of cinephilia. And just, like just feel like, you know, even if they're more casual about movies or whatever, like I want to encourage that sort of interrogative process, similarly with religion, to film and the arts and what makes something valuable or good. And so he, Aaron encouraged me to create this group. I called it Filmosophy because I think that kind of fit the tone of what I wanted to do with it. And so we would have a viewing of a film at the church once a month. We would invite people, have snacks, drinks, and then there would be a discussion afterwards. And so that was going on for a while, several years actually. And then once the pandemic hit, then it's like, okay, everything's changing for everybody. So that's when I had somebody encourage me to get into the Exvangelical group. That's where I met our mutual friend, Chad Hill.
Yes.
And he and I started to talk. And it's funny because I saw his intro post in the group and it was a GIF of the Virgin Spring. And I was
heard him talk about that movie. He loves it so much.
And I was like, oh my God, dude, he's literally posting a GIF for my favorite movie. Mm. So I kind of responded to him and then we started talking. And then I had an idea to kind of invite him to co-create this online version of my Filmosophy Club and kind of like tweak its vision a little bit to encourage other people who are not just locally to where I was at the church, but anywhere, mm-hmm. like anybody could be involved in it. It became a weekly thing. And that's literally the best thing to come out of the pandemic for me was that group because nice. I made some great friendships. We still do it every week. That's where I met you, Andrew. And that's how all of this kind of came about. It's funny because my first launching of the online Filmosophy, mm-hmm. we did, so this is before your time, but we did the Faith Trilogy because I was like, a lot of people haven't seen these movies. And I was like, this is the mm-hmm. time to catch people yeah. and go like, here, let's like set shove this in yeah. front of our faces and let's pick this stuff apart. And so that's where we are now. And I'll if you want to interject with anything, I'll let you. I know I spoke for a while.
Yeah, so. That's great. I was just going to say that's so interesting because I was asking before we started recording, how did Filmosophy come about? Now I know. That's great. Chad invited me. He is here in Arkansas. You are actually now here in Arkansas, which is cool. Chad, I'd met through a film festival here, just Instagram, said, hey, I like your film. It was set in a church. It's called The Invitation. And I was like, this guy seems pretty cool. We should DM. And we talked and then he invited me. It's basically how that went. He's been on the podcast a couple of times and he's hopefully planning to come on for this series in a few weeks as well. But I'm so glad because I think the first one that I came into Filmosophy for was The Witch last Halloween, which, is such a great film. But yes, that's so fascinating to hear all of that. And are you ready to move on and talk more about the film itself?
Yes. if you'll allow me.
Yes, absolutely. So the question that I'm kind of going to ask my guests, and I'll just kind of repeat it here, is basically I'm asking you to select a film that's been really meaningful to you, like on a faith level. So whether this is something that kind of helped you to deconstruct or to change in some way, or it encouraged you while you were going through deconstruction, or maybe that you're still are, right? Because it takes a very long time. Or if there's something just that you understood very differently after going through some sort of big religious change. So what film did you select, and tell us a little bit about the film?
All right. So as I alluded to earlier, I Bergman's my guy. I could have picked a dozen Bergman films and had a billion things to say, but I picked Winter Light, which is the centerpiece to the Faith Trilogy, the loosely named Faith Trilogy. So all three films were not intended as a trilogy, but in retrospect, they were considered such. And Bergman was like, yeah, go ahead, call it that.
And that's Through Glass Darkly, and then Winter Light, and then The Silence, correct?
Yes. Yeah. So, and Winter Light is the second film. And this is one of those things I tell people, like, when I talk about these things, I love all three films in the trilogy, and they're not directly connected. So you don't have to watch them in order. Like they're not narratively connected. They're thematically connected. But each one does something like entirely different. So, the first two I think are more similar in a lot of ways, but the Silence does something completely different. And I can talk for hours about that, but Winter Light for me is the strongest of the trilogy, and it's the one that is the starkest, the most minimalist, and I just think on a craftsmanship level, I love all of them again, but this is the one that for me just, I don't know. There's some films, for all the Bergman films I've seen, I mean, there's tons that I've watched once and I'm like, oh, like I would like to watch that again, but this is one of the few that I've seen just multiple times. And I keep returning to. So there's a lot of about this film that is oddly specific to me in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I trained to be a preacher in my deconstruction. And this is a film about a preacher who loses his faith and who is basically confronting the silence of God, in the face of illness, in the face of worldwide despair, in the face of his own trauma. His wife had died several years earlier. It's talked about. There are things that he cannot let go of. There are things that he is that. Specifically, it seems about this religion that keep him boxed in. So a couple other things about this film that, again, relate to me personally. First of all, just about Bergman in general, I am from a Swedish background. My grandmother, her parents immigrated from Sweden. So back in 2017, actually, my wife and I went on a trip to Sweden. It was my first time overseas.
Cool.
And I got to meet my dad's extended family. And his cousin lives 100 feet from a 15th century church.
Wow.
Very similar in a lot of ways to what you see in the film. And so that evoked a lot of interesting things for me too, when I saw that church in person. And while I was out there too, I should mention, I got to visit Fora, which is the island off the coast where Bergman lived. And I had a private tour with a woman who's a friend of my dad's cousin who worked at the Bergman Center. And she showed me where certain things were filmed and different films that he did. And I even got a private tour I got to sit in his personal theater.
Where he is in like the Criterion supplements, like they're watching? That's so cool.
He watched it. So it was amazing, man. And he watched two films a day on average in that theater. I got to sit in the seat, and it was awesome. Like it's really, and I mean, this whole trip for me was mind blowing. It was sort of like a pilgrimage because my dad's cousin took my wife and I to see my great grandfather's cabin. We had to take a rowboat to get there because it was like, it's like a mile from his house, but they have a little boat and we had to get in there and he had to row us there because there's no roads that connect to it. So felt pretty awesome to experience that. being so used to living in not just LA for most of my life, but just any place that's maybe where I lived in Northern California is maybe not as metropolitan, but it's still like part of civilization, So there's a lot about that resonated with me about the atmosphere of this film too. The relationship that Tomas, the pastor, has to Marta, the woman who is in love with him in this film, really hits home. So Marta is she's kind of for most of the film sitting on the sidelines watching Tomas. I'll just call him Thomas because that's how in English that's how you say it.
And there's sort of the doubting Thomas parallel too, so that works.
Exactly. So she's kind of sitting on the sidelines trying to help him through his self-torture, however she can. But she's atheist. She even mocks his beliefs a bit, but she plays along whenever she sees fit, you know, just to be with him.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot about that overlaps in my life. 'Cause my wife, who I've been with for several years, she's not religious at all. She grew up Jehovah's mm-hmm. Witness, but she rejected it very young, pretty cleanly. Wow. She's pretty comfortably atheist. But like Marta, she attended church with me early in our relationship, you know, when I was going to the progressive church,
mm-hmm.
but even that didn't really jive for her. But so in my life, just on a personal level, a lot of my hookups with religious trauma, they're things that she doesn't relate to. And frankly, she's grown to hate, like not hate me, but just hate seeing what this does to me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I think I inadvertently will like push her away if I feel like something she won't understand or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I see that behavior from Thomas in this film.
Yeah.
And he gets to the point of being cruel about it, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that is a lot of where that kind of jives for me in sort of my deconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of me setting the stage, but if you have more to say before I go any further.
That's all so good already. But yeah, I was just going to kind of check in about. So this film is something that as I was watching through Bergman, so I feel like I'm kind of been on my Bergman watch through for the first time for like, I don't know, 6 years or something. But this was the first one that I came upon that I was like, wow, so much resonates with me here. And it's so much about faith and doubt and all of that. And I think it's like there's a certain level of like anytime I'm watching a film that's older and there's like a common experience that I just like, I love that feeling of being like, oh, this is someone from a totally different part of the world, totally different era than me. And yet we have these things in common and kind of that collective human experience and having that, but also like in a church and like in a small church with not a lot of people in it, like that, there's something that's so familiar about that opening sequence that I was like, oh my gosh, I got to really key into this. And the first time I watched this was in 2018. So I was looking back to see when it was. So loved it even more the second time. I want to say this might be my favorite of his films so far that I've seen, but I still have Fanny and Alexander to go and some major ones that I haven't seen yet. But I was so thrilled when you chose this because it seems like the perfect first film for this series as well, because it does encapsulate so much of the doubt and kind of some other things we'll probably get into. So anyway, that's really all I had to say as far as before we get into the even meatier stuff. But so I guess you kind of already answered some of this, but do you have more about why you selected this film?
Yeah. So the last time I watched this before yesterday was a year and a half ago. Again, like I said, for the Filmosophy kickoff for the virtual Filmosophy, and where I wanted people to sort of kind of start reinvestigating beliefs again. And yeah, like you mentioned Trump in the 2016 election, all of that stuff definitely was not really, it didn't really add to my deconstruction because I was like, I was already way deep into it by then.
For a while.
But like, I was just like, oh man, I mean, this is a little further than I thought it would be going. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But what really hit me harder than the Trump thing was the pandemic thing, because I could see people being manipulated by somebody like, say, Donald Trump. And it's mind blowing in a lot of ways, but there's something very rubber meets the road about COVID and the church's reaction to it that I think ousted me even further away from relating to any semblance of an evangelical belief system. So I watched this a year and a half ago, was reinvestigating beliefs, but once things were moving along, after seeing what unfolded in the world over this past couple of years in response and the church's unwillingness at large to be humble and come to terms with a deadly plague, that shook me just in a different way. Throughout all of these years, even though I lost all of my, I would say almost all of my supernatural beliefs, I felt compelled and drawn to the Christ story, you know, whether you quantify it as myth or however you want to say. And yet it was earlier that this year, for the first time, I felt comfortable shedding the label of Christian from my identity. So this is sort of in a way, this is me like coming out a bit about it, because I've never publicly said that I'm like, quote, not a Christian. I don't think explicitly. I've alluded to it or whatever, but like for me, for me, part of healing from the religious trauma, I felt like, was me having to tie that chapter up and put it behind me. Even though like I still love like my progressive church family is central, like for me, I felt like I have gotten what I felt I needed out of it. And I've moved to a new stage. I don't really like the baggage of the word atheist either, but it probably more accurately represents where I am right now spiritually. I feel my identity will always have ties to Christianity in some form, and my work, what the stuff that I write and try to create, I will always reflect that in some way. But for me personally, I don't see the utility of the culture of Christianity, like frankly, religion as a whole, as a net positive anymore, mainly because of like COVID was the straw that broke the camel's back a bit, because it's like I did before. I was like, okay, there's a net positive to religious belief. There's positive things that people get on a personal level, like neurologically, like I try to keep it scientific, neurologically from through prayer or through a relationship with God or whatever. But like that sort of like the scales tipped for me in the other direction now, like seeing the sociological impact that a lot of churches are like, oh, well, we need to meet in person. Like, let's go meet in person. Like, you know, fuck whatever the restrictions are. Like, we're here to stand our ground. And it's just like this persecution complex that the evangelical church has had for so long.
So many people because of this crisis.
And so it's just the anti-intellectual and anti-science bias has been swaying people like so far into literally killing people around them. And I just see so much irreversible harm being done in a very practical way. And but something else I want to bring up here is it's sort of like an ironic reversal on evangelical Christian epistemology, right? So they are conditioned to believe that unseen forces are always at play to steal and damn your soul for eternity. And yet people overlap into this sort of anti-vax or COVID denial belief systems. They're literally killing people around them, but they don't see the immediate harm in living a life like that. So they're like, what? I don't see any harm. It's just, like this hypocritical irony. So I feel like going back to the film, like, Thomas is like, it's his job. His job is being this pastor. And he's only now reckoning with the fact that the world is crumbling around him. You know, there's this subplot about this member of the church who doesn't see any purpose in living because of these stuff he's reading about China and the atomic bomb and all the horrible things that will be becoming in the new generation. And he's not able to help, in fact, quite the opposite. And it's sort of like it's this pressure cooker point where that conversation in the film is like, his job is showing that he believes and being the comfort for other people, but he's not allowed any comfort for himself. He's not allowed any self-care. He's coughing the entire film. Like, he's ill from his job. And it's a pretense, like this being in this position. And I'm not saying like being a clergyman is the only thing that will result in that, but it's literally like par and course for the job is having to be a certain type of spiritual leader that for so many people will just completely backfire. And I mean, you know, my friend Aaron, who's the pastor of Central Avenue, I introduced him to this film soon after I met him. And I mean, he fell in love with it. Obviously, as a pastor, he can really relate to this level, to this film in ways that I can't. But yeah, it's sort of like there is just something incredibly sad about, again, there's a lot of great things about religion, you know, but this is sort of like, for me, it's just very fresh. I mean, this was 1962. Yeah. So it's a fresh take on saying like, yes, there were atheists and communist filmmakers, whatever, like, but there weren't a lot of films that interrogated the nature of religious belief before this, the way that this film does.
Yeah.
And that's what, again, like you said, it's what, 60 years ago or whatever, but it feels it's just as relevant today. Like,
yeah, so much resonates with it. Yeah. The conversation you're talking about there with, what, Jonas, I think his name is, Max von Sydow's character.
Yeah.
That there's a few scenes, like as I'm watching through Bergman movies, I'm like, oh, I need to take note of this line that he just said. It's so great. Oh, that next one's great too. And then I end up just like typing out the entire thing. This whole is so well written. But I had a sense this time watching it that, this may be the first time that he said this out loud to someone. Is that your feeling about it? Like that he kind of, basically confesses that he doesn't believe in God, and that something about this pressure cooker conversation, that that's a good way to put it, brought that out in him, and he leaves the room and weeps, and then he's remarkably emotionally detached for the rest of the movie after that, which I think is so interesting. Even though like big heavy things are happening around him, but yeah, that scene is so amazing.
And so that's that scene, going back to that, so some of my favorite moments in the film, so there's a scene, I guess you could say, like, I don't want to spoil this film, but there's like things about it, it's not one of those films I think you can really spoil too much.
That's how I feel about it too. But so if you feel like you need to
talk about that stuff, you can. If anybody wants a spoiler warning or whatever, like, here's what, there's one event, I think, mainly just one event that I think people would feel that a little spoilery about.
Yeah.
So the thing I'm referring to is he has this conversation where his belief system breaks down. And what the first scene though is, it's a husband and a wife. The wife is pregnant. She brings in her husband, who's Max von Sydow, his character Jonas. And they explain that he's despairing at sort of the state of the world. She's explaining it because he seems really just kind of speechless. Mm-hmm. She's talking about his just like utter deep depression that he's in. And she's describing it, and the shot is so brilliant. It's a trademark Bergman shot, though. If you've seen enough Bergman films, you'll recognize this as like specifically Bergman. One person's facing forward. There's another person facing to the side next to them, and in a perpendicular direction. It's almost like a joke. Like, I've seen Bergman parodies, and it's always that specific shot. But he utilizes it so incredible here, because she's explaining his depression, and her husband is looking out of frame, like he's detached. So she's like explaining the situation, and then Thomas has to say, "Okay, we must trust God." And he looks, and then Jonas. That's when Jonas looks at him, and there's just this look in his eye, like, "Are you fucking kidding me?"
Exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah. And then as he says it, and then Thomas can't look him in the eye again. Like he's like, I'm going to look down. And I've even seen, there's like these deep dive, like, I think it's called art house shit posting. Like there are these little memes where they take memes from Winter Light. And that's like one of the,
that's great.
I'll have to send you some of the memes. Yeah, they just like, nice. Yeah, they take that scene and it's like almost comical, like the way it plays out. But yeah, so there's this thing that plays out where after that scene, the wife is going to go home, and then Jonas comes back, and that's when the world is unraveling for Thomas a bit. And by the time Jonas comes back and they have that second conversation, this is where he bluntly exposes his atheism after talking about all of the stuff that's going on. He's like, I can't, basically summarizing, he's like, I can't hold up this veneer anymore. Like there's no God. Like, I mean, how can we how can we try to justify, and you know, this is the classic idea of problem of evil. Mm-hmm. How can we justify the fact that what is going on in the world? Like, it doesn't make any sense. And there's no point in trying to console anybody about this. Mm-hmm. Because there's nothing good about it. There's no good. You can't argue it's part of some divine plan or right, yeah. what have you. Cause you already have so much limited knowledge. But he blurts all of this kind of rhetoric out. And then once Jonas leaves, what I love is that scene, there's a slow kind of push in on the camera on him. And he, after he says there is no God, it's like the room lights up. This is my first time noticing this specific like lighting change. Like the room gets lighter,
it gets really brighter. Yeah.
Yeah. And then he goes like, now I'm free at last. Hmm. Like, it's like he got that off of his chest and now it's like, it's out and it's done. Mm-hmm. And that's just something I alluded to it earlier, but the stark simplicity, there's an utter lack of music. It's incredibly quiet. Mm-hmm. There's just an emptiness to the atmosphere in this film. But I know someone disagree, but I always find Bergman very entertaining. Like, I always find his films very engaging, even at a slower pace. Like, I'm never really bored watching his films. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's just, it's utterly quiet. It's very simple. It's minimalist. And I don't like to use this term really when talking about films, but in a technical sense, I think it's like a perfect film. Like it's just restrained. Every performance is on point. And it's just really raw and unpretentious. And so for me also, there's another personal layer to it there. Cause I talked about how I got into theater before I got into film. So there's something about it that has a stage play quality, but it also doesn't feel stagey. It feels very aptly painted onto a film canvas.
Right. That's what you mean.
Mm-hmm. But still using minimal locations, like very just simple atmosphere. Because a pet peeve for me personally is watching, half the Hollywood, frankly, it just seems like half of the freaking nominated Oscar films are like stage adaptations. Or like, all right, well, we don't know what to do. We'll adapt a stage play.
Yeah.
And then it's just
feel
like
that staginess to it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like, okay, we're just going to watch actors chew the scenery for 2 hours and it's going to be just shot like a certain way, and all right, simple, one and done, out the can. It doesn't feel like there's any like conviction to the actual film. It's like it's leaning so heavily on the source material. And I mean, I think Bergman, one thing I love about him, he started in the stage, but I do think he's an incredible director as well as a writer. Like, he knows how to write and he knows how to direct. He knows when to be visual, when to not. And even when he feels like he's leaning too far one direction, he will subvert himself. So one example of that is Winterlight is an incredibly rhetorically dense film. Like, there's a lot of quiet moments throughout the film, but I mean, it's just, it's conversation. Like, it's just about like, just raw, just laying it out on their conversations. But then the final film in the trilogy, The Silence, that film is like, there's probably like 20 lines the whole movie. Like, it was the first time he just completely tried to gut dialogue almost completely out of his film. So that's what I love, is like seeing filmmakers challenge themselves in ways that they still kind of have control over. But even in this case, I think the rhetorical approach works incredibly well. It's not overbearing either. There's even scenes where it seems like an important conversation is about to take place. And then the train just runs through it. And it's just like, well, whatever's going to be said. I mean, it was after this guy's suicide. Spoiler, there it is.
Yeah, that's the thing. You never said it yet.
I didn't say it. I was explaining the scene leading up to it. But after he learns about the guy's suicide, which in some sense he prompted with his own religious baggage. He's in the car and there's a conversation and it's just like, I feel like, okay, we're going to explain what happened. And then the train runs through and it's just like, the words don't matter at that point. So.
Yes. Such incredible film. I've made note of a few lines like in that scene. So there's that scene with him and Jonas. Max von Sydow, and it's essentially a monologue, and it's so arresting. I also really love the letter from Marta, where we get this close up of her, this long letter that she's written to him. So I have a few just like lines from those that I think are so good. But actually, this is with him and Jonas. He's talking about. It's like when he ran up against the problem of evil, essentially, was when he was like serving during a war and just seeing so many atrocities, and God is silent, right? And that's kind of where he goes with it. But when he's talking about himself as like a young pastor and so eager, he says, "Picture my prayers to an echo God who gave benign answers and reassuring blessings." And just like that, the word echo God, I think, just was so felt so familiar. Like when I look back at my own faith, like that's exactly what I was doing. It was an echo chamber that I was calling God, basically. That was so that just kind of nailed it. Let's see, I don't know, that was the main one I wanted to bring up. There's a scene too. I always feel, so this is like a personal thing, but I always feel this personal connection with Marta too, because she talks about her hands, and I have always had severe eczema on my hands.
I have psoriasis on my hands, dude.
There you go. And they don't ever say like what exactly it is. I was reading actually in the book that's with the Criterion Bergman set, the writer calls it eczema. And I was like, I think the way it's described, it sounds kind of like eczema. But anyway, just like, I think in general, there's a lot of physical illness in this movie. There's that. He's got the flu or something. He's coughing the whole time. There's so much physical ailment, which I think is just pointing back to that problem of like suffering and evil. And how do you make this idea jive with the idea of a loving God? And I just think that's a really effective way to do that. The hand that she describes, her open sores on her hand, and it's like, I've been there and it sucks.
I have three open cuts on my hands right now from my psoriasis.
Yikes.
That's dude, I'm not like, it's so funny because I could talk about this stuff for hours, but my psoriasis is like another point of deconstruction. Cause like when I was younger, I was part of a study where they're like, we're doing a psoriasis study. And it's like, I got an experimental drug. An experimental hand like foam that you put on your hands, and they're like, cool. All right. So you try this, you log it, you put it on every day for 2 weeks. It completely healed my psoriasis 100%. And I was like, oh my God, thank you guys so much. So where do I get this? They're like, oh, you're not allowed to have it because, it hasn't been, the FDA hasn't approved it, whatever. I was like, are you serious? Like the one cure that I found that could help me is like torn away. And for years, it's like, I tried to ask doctors about it. I said, I found a foam once. I was part of a study. There's this foam that's going to like help my hands heal. And they're like, oh, why don't you try this foam? And I would try a foam and it would work for a week and then it would no longer work. So it's sort of like I was given this reassurance that there is a healing end to my suffering at some point. And it was torn away. And then like I've had other doctors try to figure it out. And like the conclusion, it seems, is like this is just something you have. It is an ailment you have in your life and you have to deal with it.
Yeah.
So I've stopped even seeking cures because I'm like, you know what? I think this is just going to be a lifelong thing and I have to learn to live with it. So.
Yeah, that's basically the same situation here. It's like deal with it when it flares up and that's that. And so there's just so much illness happening in this film. One thing I like about it too, that I noticed this time more is like, especially in that opening scene, but then throughout the film too, you just see different people's, like how everyone in church is like, experiencing church a little bit differently, and when they're all at the altar taking the communion wafer, they like, it's all in their performances, but like one person's kind of like balking about it, and then later on you have he talks to this child that comes into the schoolroom whose older brother is very devout and is going to be confirmed, and he doesn't want to, and he can tell he feels uncomfortable talking about it. And he's like, why don't you want to do it? And he's like, I don't know, I'm just not into it or whatever. And just like, I've thought a lot lately about like different people's capacity for religious belief. And I think that's an interesting thing. I don't really have anywhere else to go with that, but I think that's kind of present here in the film.
It's in the very first scene where you see like they're doing the service. The guy's playing the organ and you see the cutaways and some people are reading from the hymnal and they're very focused. And then there's the kid who's asleep and his mom's like, sit up, like, look like you're interested. Like, and then there's other people who are yawning. And like, so there's just that very visual representation of those different capacities from the outset. Even the guy who's playing the organ, he's an essential part of this service and he doesn't give a shit. Like, he's looking at his little watch like while he's playing with like the other hand.
How soon can I get out of here? Exactly. So that's so interesting seeing like that's his reaction. The other person who's running the service, we find out, doesn't believe in God either. So like what an interesting crapshoot of a church service.
And interestingly though, the guy who does have faith is the one who is the most ailed and the most disabled.
Yeah, I was gonna actually, that's exactly where I was going. So there's this guy who has a disability and at the end of the film he has this really really interesting reading of the story of the Passion of the Christ, and he kind of tells that, and for me that is such an incredible scene too, because it does kind of cast, and maybe it causes him to almost re-grab his faith a little bit or something. How do you read that scene?
I see it as he may know, so like the scene at the end is like, okay, well here's a, It's a classic Bergman-esque twist, I say. Like here's all of the bleak, terrible shit. Now, what is like one thing that will like give us a reason to stand on our feet after this? And like that's the scene where it's like, okay, well, he's talking about Christ's suffering and he's saying like, I have these ailments. In some ways, I've suffered more than Christ. And we put so much focus on Jesus's suffering. He's like, but the suffering, we're not focusing on the right suffering. He's saying like, I've probably suffered more than Jesus has like over the realm of my life physically. But he says the true pain for Christ, it seems in this story, is the people that he loved abandoning him. The people that he, and the God that he felt, you know, he just lost all sense of hope, his lack of his losing his sense of hope, losing his sense of love. That was the suffering.
Yeah.
Like the physical pain is one thing, but he's like, this is the real suffering. And so, I was just going to say he frames that. And yeah, you're looking at Thomas's face and it's sort of like at the end of the film, he goes back to his service. He does his thing. And so it's sort of like, I don't think he believes anymore, but he can read meaning. After that conversation, I think he has just enough to read meaning into standing in front of people, even if it's all bullshit. He can stand in front of people and say like, here is something that I can offer, here's something about this story that has value. And see, that's for me, like for a long time that's where I grasp onto and I'm like, okay, there's something about the Christ story that I can't let go of. And yeah, I'm in a place now where I feel comfortable letting go of it, so to speak. But the story itself, like, it's sort of like, I don't see it as entirely untrue. I think there's things about in the Bible that were true. I think there's a mixture of all sorts of different things. And it's just such a hodgepodge. Nobody's ever going to really know. But almost I see it like Batman. Like Batman's gonna like have like there's gonna be an iteration of Batman, like the Nolan Batman. It's like, okay, well, what's the version of this story that's palatable for almost palatable for like a reality that we live in? You know, so like there's things in Nolan's, like say Dark Knight, that may not be literally true, but there's like sort of a metaphorical truth that rhymes with a lot of the sort of like crime and corruption that we deal with in this world. So
There's enough of that kind of wisdom to be found in those biblical accounts that maybe Thomas is able to keep it going in that way. But yeah, the writing of that scene is so good, because I haven't thought about the level of doubt that Christ was feeling either, because he, like, the way he explains, like, Jesus must have, you know, thought, okay, none of my friends got this that I've been telling them forever, like, how this is gonna go, and none of them understood it, and they've all abandoned me, and God has abandoned me, so this must have all been a lie. And like I've you know, I know that Christ said, my God, why did you forsake me, but I've never thought of it in those terms. And as I'm, like, listening to him tell this story in the film for the second time last night, I'm like, where's the lie? Like, this is like a really good interpretation of this passage, I think. Yeah. And I think it's really, and it's compelling in a way I've never heard, you know, that passage described before. But yeah, I really like that. There's a lot about just the idea of certainty, like certainty versus kind of embracing mystery. And this also was in the Criterion set, and it's the essay about all three of those films. But it talks about how Through a Glass Darkly is more about, I can't remember exactly the wording of it, but basically that one's about kind of holding on to certainty, and this one's about letting go of certainty, maybe. Mm-hmm. And I think I may not be explaining it great, but the certainty thing is something that has been a big deal for me. It's just that, like, I think it's sort of like the Enlightenment thinking of, like, we can find the logical, reasonable ways to explain everything with science or whatever. And at some point that kind of got mixed in with evangelical Christianity. And now it's like, okay, like, we can find the answer for each thing, like what the Bible means about all of this stuff. And then it's this brick wall that you are, like, all these things are built together. And if you pull one brick out, then it all crumbles, because we have to have everything just so. I think,
but that's the way the religion is framed, though, and that's the thing, is the deconstruction. That's where I think people. Sorry to interrupt you on this, by the way.
No, you're fine. You go ahead.
I just had to interject. Like, the thing about deconstruction is, like, people don't. You don't. It's the idea is you don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's not destruction. It's deconstruction. So right. You are removing things carefully, piece by piece. I mean, some people need to destroy it and rebuild. Mm-hmm. It's just because all those pieces, none of them work. But the more wise move is to be like, let's take this loose piece out. Let's see if a better piece fits there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, or let's take this piece out. Let's start a fresh construction, and let's just keep an open eye, look for any holes in that as we rebuild.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it too, because it wasn't like I pulled one brick out and the whole thing crumbled right away. It was more like, okay, this treatment of LGBTQ+ people, like, it from what I've experienced, does not seem that the evangelical Christian response to this is adequate. So then I have to look, okay, what's holding that brick up? Maybe is, like, well, this idea of biblical inerrancy that I've always been hammered into me. You know, I've heard arguments against it. Maybe I should look into those more, and realizing, oh, if I let go of biblical inerrancy, like, it really opens up in a way that was terrifying at first, but so freeing. And like, that was a big piece for me. But yeah, I think it's what pieces are faulty, and then you can, yeah, figure out what is working. But yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Very interesting.
So before we kind of wind down, I think there's a little bit of an elephant in the room for some people here. So if anybody's seen Paul Schrader's First Reformed,
that is
a total, like, so what's frustrating is when I first saw that film a few years ago, I knew very little about it, but I watched it and I was livid for the first, like, half of it, because it's literally a ripoff of this film.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Almost.
Yeah. Like, for the first half to, like, two thirds, it's like, it's almost like he took the same script and, like, modernized it. Mm-hmm. But, like, it's not, I mean, yeah, you can remake something, but what's frustrating is he never pays homage to Bergman's film. Like, mm-hmm. he hasn't said, like, oh, this is what it is or what, like, but, and yet at the same time, Schrader has said very clearly that Bergman's a huge influence on him.
Yeah.
But, like, it's just like, ugh, come on, man. Like, so that frustrated me, but First Reformed did for me, like, resurrect itself in the last third, because it became its own Schrader-y thing.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was pulling from this, and I should say, you know, Bresson's Diary of a Country Priest, mm-hmm. Like, it's basically a full-on ripoff of Winter Light for the first two thirds, with also, like, bits of Diary of a Country Priest inserted into the plot. And then the last third of it's like Taxi Driver-y.
Yeah, they like they got the Taxi Driver in there for sure. And apparently Ordet, I've not seen Ordet, but I've heard that it has some parallels there. I actually haven't seen Diary of a Country Priest either. Yeah. And that's one that I need to catch up with. But yes. So a lot of parallels to First Form. So if you're listening to this and you're like, Winter Light sounds a little heavy for me, first of all, give it a chance. It's really good. But if First Reformed is more palatable, it's a very similar movie. And you've got someone recognizable like Ethan Hawke in there.
Yeah. So,
but yeah. And it's interesting too, how they modernized that. I guess that's for another conversation, but instead of sort of the existential crisis of, you know, these people on the other side of the world are being taught to hate us and they're developing atomic weapons, it's about environmentalism and how the world is going to end very soon because of global warming. And I thought that was a cool way to bring that up to a modern context in a way, but
yeah, that's true.
Anywho, Winterlight, so good. Go ahead.
No, go for it, man.
Yeah. I'll just kind of wrap us up. This has been so good and so interesting. And I believe it is streaming on Criterion Channel. If you wanted to stream it, you can get the Criterion disc as well. I always love an excuse to pull down my Bergman set that I'm still working through, but it's such a beautiful, if you want to buy a physical set, it's one of their biggest and most expensive, but it's really nice.
I was going to say, depending on your commitment here, like if you're super interested in Bergman and you have a little bit of coin, like the best value is really getting that like big ass Bergman set, because it's got 39 of his films.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that.
And even when I got it, I had seen 43 Bergman films and it had a couple that I had not seen in the set.
There you go. Yeah.
But there's a couple obviously that I have seen that are not in it. So of course I have a little gripe, but you know,
it's not a complete set, but it is really beautiful. And you can get it half off a couple times a year if you watch the sales. So
If you're, I don't know when this episode's coming out, but right now it's November.
Yes.
And it, Criterion has their Barnes and Noble half off sale. So
that's just exactly where I got it a couple of years ago. I was like, I'm going to run down the first day of this sale and buy the Bergman set. Well, that is Winterlight. And thank you so much for sharing and for sharing so many personal things too. I really appreciate that. And I think hopefully this conversation is helpful for people. Thanks again so much for joining, Andrew. And maybe we can have you back again sometime.
Yeah, man, it was fun. I always down to jump into these conversations, as you know.
So. Yes. Wow, that was a really great discussion, and I'm so appreciative to Andrew for coming on the show and telling his story. I hope you found it interesting as well, and because of the personal nature of the topic we discussed, I'll invite you, if you have any questions, feel free to shoot me an email or an Instagram DM. Links to those things are in the show notes. Stay tuned for next time. We'll have another faith discussion, and it looks like the film will be either the Martin Scorsese missionary epic Silence, or it may also be the A24 horror film Saint Maud. Plans are still up in the air, but one of those two will likely be next. I'll also review something new, which will probably be the upcoming Lady Gaga Adam Driver film House of Gucci. Until then, thank you for listening to Art House Garage. We've got a few years worth of episodes. You can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. Learn more at appallingproductions.com. If you want to support Art House Garage, leave a rating or review in your podcast app, or you can buy an Art House Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. Stay in the loop about Art House Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter. That's at arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Arthouse Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening, and until next time, keep it snob free.